Thanks very much for joining, everyone. I'll do a quick intro and then hand over to these gents over here to take you through some slides. I've got over here Paul. Paul is the head of risk consulting at Willis Towers Watson, where he heads up the insurance consulting practice. I'll summarize his bio. He's got 30 years of experience across a number of very senior executive roles, chief actuary, CRO, etc. And his experience has included starting a life company in Asia. So it should be quite interesting to hear what he has to say today. Kenny will be also talking. He's a senior consultant with Paul. And to summarize his bio, so using a bit of artistic license here, he's got 8 years' experience in the industry, specializes in applying advanced analytical techniques, and the most interesting part is he's got a PhD in genetics and insurance, specializing in adverse selection. So it's sort of like a doctorate in anti-selection, so glad he's on our side. You've heard all the housekeeping stuff before, so I won't repeat those pieces. I'll say as part of a new entrant in this market, we spend a lot of time talking about good disruption, so I'm very keen to hear what these guys have to say. So I'll get up the stage and hand over to Paul.
Okay, thanks. Okay, just for those who don't know us, Kenny's the good-looking one on the right, I'm the one on the left. Let me just start by just a couple of stats. Citibank are estimating that the banking sector will lose 1.3 million jobs over the next 5 years to fintech industries. Experts predict there's going to be more than 30 billion connected devices by the year 2020. According to Forrester Research, most companies are only analysing 12% of their current data, and annualised spending growth over the next 5 years is going to be 24% per annum in the life insurance industry worldwide. It's probably going to be the only sector where you're going to see employment growth within that industry. The other thing is, when I'm going to be talking about life insurance and some of the disruptive forces that may be there, I'm going to take a little bit of poetic liberty in talking about more financial services, even more broader. So there is going to be connections into banking, general insurance and life insurance. Interesting, in the Financial Review yesterday, it was reported that the global banking industry is asking for $200 million US to actually spend on investigating blockchain technology and how that's going to impact the banking sector. Okay, let's just start off with talking about what is a disruptor. Look, a disruptor is more than just innovation. It's innovation that actually creates a new market and or a value network. And we're going to use this term value network throughout our presentation. And it usually displaces market leaders and alliances. So is disruption something that should be feared by the insurance companies or the insurance industry? Or is this something that they should consider about harnessing to actually improve their customer experience? So we're going to probably start off by looking at the broader market and disruptors within that, and then take it then through to the life insurance industry, and then look at some very specific type of disruptor technologies and how they potentially could be displacing the market. So if we look at recent disruptions, as I mentioned before, typically we do see that they create a new market and or value network, and it does displace leaders and alliances. What we also see is that it can often drive societal change and operate at a low cost. In other words, one of the value propositions often is that it is at a lower cost and or more choice. And we do see from time to time that it does generate controversy and leverage trends. What we're showing you at the bottom of this page here is Google Trends, and of course it must be true then. And this is showing you the terminology disruptor and how often that's coming up through either through search engines or through articles, etc. And you can see here it really kind of started to come up through disruptor in an industry in the mid-90s. Slowed down during the GFC for obvious reasons, but we've now started to see since the GFC a significant increase in the use of disruptor within the internet. And I suppose the question here is, why do we think that's so? Oops, wrong way. What I want to do here is actually look at a few broader markets and see, look at the disruptors and the lessons that we learnt from that. If we actually look at the first example here, not all innovations are actually disruptive. And if I go back to the the development of the automobile back in the kind of mid to late 1800s. Initially, that wasn't disruptive. It was actually very innovative, but the car was a very expensive luxury, and so it didn't really in any way displace the horse-drawn vehicle. It really wasn't until 1908 when Henry Ford developed the Model T Ford, and it was a lot, the Model T, and that was a lot more, and it was mass-produced, and so the cost came down substantially. And so really it was the mass production of the automobile that actually displaced the horse-drawn vehicle, and hence being the disruptor there. So the lesson learned here is really make it cheaper. Now, it's interesting, a quote from Henry Ford was, well, if I'd asked the customer what they wanted, they would have told me a faster horse. I mean, an interesting quote, but it could have easily come from Steve Jobs today. What we're also seeing here is that for other disruptors, they're actually harnessing the power of others. And so if you look at, Facebook, which is the most popular media provider, actually creates no content. If you look at Alibaba, one of the most valuable retailers in the world, it actually has no inventory. And then if you actually look at Airbnb, largest provider of accommodation in the world, it actually owns no real estate. What we're really seeing here is that digital technologies, rather than reducing human interactions, they're now capable of facilitating sharing and connections in the real world. And so the lessons you can see here from Airbnb is the facilitation here is leveraging the sharing economy. For the last example here, disruptors are sometimes just make the customer experience a lot better. When we look at Uber, which is growing significantly over the last 5 to 7 years, it fundamentally provides a platform that makes it easy for passengers and drivers to connect to basically provide a service. It's another interesting example, Uber, because often for certain industries, it's often quoted that it's a highly regulated market and that's going to make it hard for a disruptor to enter. Well, the taxi industry was actually a very highly regulated market in a number of different countries, including most states in Australia. And Uber has actually been able to displace the various regulations and actually then secure a significant foothold. Now, the lesson learned for him, make it participative. For Uber, it's make it easy. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's the only lesson for each of these. Of course, if Uber was more expensive than taxis, I'm sure it wouldn't actually take off. So there's an element of make it cheaper, but the key driving force or lesson there is make it easy. So let's now move over to what we see within the life insurance industry, and do we think that the life insurance industry is actually disruptable? I'm sure that's a word that I can use. So let's start looking at some of the evidence. When we look at the life insurance side, what we're showing you here is, obviously on the left, what do we think the factors that make life insurance vulnerable? And we kind of see three key factors here. Customer loyalty is generally considered to be hard to achieve. Excuse me. And so likely that customers can be induced to move elsewhere. Other factor we're seeing is insurance is not bought, it's sold. Now, this prevailing mindset actually threatens to leave the industry open, I think, to a new business model that actually turns this on its head. And the third thing here is that incumbents are typically perceived to be slow to make use of available technologies. And I think this poor perception does impact customer behaviours. Now, from a resilience factor, I think there's two major factors. Excuse me. The first is that manufacturing of insurance is actually a very capital-intensive industry, and so this does limit the types of new entrants that can come into that actually have to have access to quite substantial funding or access to capital. The second thing is that the insurance market, both from a distribution and from a manufacturing perspective, is heavily regulated, and so that is going to limit the opportunity for a disruptor to come in via a kind of low-cost, simplified product structure. But as I did mention under the Uber example, often there is ways of circumventing a lot of these highly regulated environments. On the left here, we've got three components or three boxes or other factors. Changing customer attitudes, and I would say that changing customer attitudes is actually a vulnerability for the life insurance industry, and this is how customers are potentially viewing the way that they will interact, buy, share, etc. Access to data and availability of expertise I would typically have put within the resilience side of the balance. However, I think that these two boxes are a lot more fluid and could actually move between being a vulnerability for the industry as well as from a resilience perspective. And I'm going to ask Kenny to now come up and take us through some examples of technologies of why we think that's going to be the case.
Thanks, Paul. So I'm going to take you through a number of specific examples of disruptive technology, potential disruptive technology. I'm going to go quite quick through these, quite whirlwind really. I'm going to stay at a very high level, not much jargon, not much technical aspects of them. Really, two reasons for that. We don't have the time, simply. They're very complex and deep subjects if you get right into them. And a few of the sessions we've had at this conference have attempted to do that. Also, I don't think it would suit our purpose. I really just want to give you a flavour of what's happening there, and so we can discuss it. Now, these technologies are, some of them are already engaged in the life insurance market already. They're already influenced life insurance. We'll talk a little bit about how much further they have to go potentially there. And others are technologies which are being highly used already in general insurance, and we'll see how much of that can transfer over to life insurance. In each case, I'll also give you some examples of specialist companies who are working on these technologies. I've deliberately chosen not to mention insurance companies, just to give them more of an outside flavour. Now, I want to start with peer-to-peer, or P2P, insurance. In a nutshell, this is the ability for customers to take insurance effectively into their own hands. It operates by customers forming into groups, which would typically be family, friends, or colleagues, and within that group have the ability to share within the losses or the gains on their collective policies. Now, peer-to-peer has taken off quite quickly in general insurance, and there's a good few reasons why that is. Touching on the main ones, perhaps, transparency, so customers actually get to see the inner workings of insurance. It's not just a black box they can't really understand. Obviously, lower prices on offer if they have the good experience. And also, there's an elimination of moral hazard, which is an important effect we're seeing in general insurance. And that's due to the fact that the customers have the ability to approve or reject claims. So those making claims have to abide by what other peers are expecting of them. And there are signs that this could have success in life insurance. Let me give you an example. Brood Funds is a Dutch company. It sells income protection to self-employed individuals, or entrepreneurs, if you want to call them that. A brood fund is a bread fund in English. It's not a large step to the English version. There are typically 20 to 50 participants in a single brood fund. Those participants pay affordable premiums and can join or leave as they please. It's based on trust. Participants know one another. They can influence the policy of their cover, and doesn't discriminate on age or occupation. Peer Cover is a company that started out in New Zealand, and it covers policy excesses. So peers approve membership, and over 50% of approval is needed in order for a claim to be successful. As with brood funds and peer cover, individuals join or leave as they please and pay for the claim that has been, any claims that have been in their group. Friend insurance is in Germany, as you'll be able to tell from the flags. It was one of the first peer-to-peer providers. It sells products across motor, household, liability, and mobile. It's actually got 60 domestic insurance partners working with it, The important thing to note about friend insurance and about most, if not all, of these examples is that this is a broker model. It's not the manufacturer of insurance. Devar is a British version, sells motor insurance, and like the others, for those who are able to evidence low claims, then they'll eventually receive their premium reductions. Lemonade had a $13 million seed very recently, just last year, and is actually one of the first companies to appoint a chief behavioural officer, which signifies the sort of importance these companies, this peer-to-peer model, is placing on how the customers behave once they're in the peer-to-peer framework. Now, peer-to-peer and life insurance looks somewhat like participating business. The difference lies in the scale, connectivity and flexibility that's on offer. But ultimately and importantly, they're brokers, not manufacturers of the insurance. Perhaps the biggest challenge in life insurance will be breaking things down into small groups, as a peer-to-peer model needs to do. And that's difficult in an industry where certainty and security are paramount. So telematics, or pay-as-you-live. So this is leveraging the wealth of data being generated from telematic wearable technologies and better price and sell insurance. And the tech that's being used to generate this data is growing at a very impressive rate. I actually got scooped on this yesterday by Colin. So contact lenses that measure blood glucose through your tears, that's something that's been in development by Google. E-textiles, you may have heard of. This is becoming very big in advanced or elite sports, measuring movement and various other metrics which can help improve athletic performance. There's potential trickle-down for that into the population. And then the sort of more run-of-the-mill ones that you'll be familiar with, you probably have on you right now, fitness trackers, of course, and smartphones. The thing that brings all these together is their ability to gather data and then also communicate it outside of the individual. And the data from these technologies will help improve our understanding of risk and help price or segment it further. But also, it allows the ability to change and manage the risk, which is key. And gamification has become a bit of a buzzword in this area. Gamification is the idea of incentivizing customers usually using competition to achieve better outcomes, more positive behavior. Baseline Telematics is a Canadian Montreal-based company that's there on the slide. It specializes in three segments, pay-as-you-drive, pay-as-you-live, and actually pay-as-you-dwell, which is leveraging off of the much-hyped Internet of Things. Baseline and others see the benefits, the technology that's been developed in the motor insurance space transferring over into life. But they appreciate that there's challenges to surmount as well. Of these challenges, I'll name a few. Privacy of customer data is obviously highly important to continue getting the trust of the customer. But also the accuracy of devices. We're not probably there quite yet. I went for a run with my partner on Sunday. I measured 4 kilometres, she measured 5. We went with her number, but which is embarrassingly low, of course. But and also there's a fraud risk as well. There may one day be a time where we're handing our fitness trackers off to somebody who's prepared to do 40 laps of Hyde Park for us. So there's obviously things there that leave it open, but that may change over time. Next one is on blockchain, and I'm surprised not have heard too much about this over the course of this conference so far. So I'm glad, or maybe it's been in a session I've not attended. So the blockchain sits behind smart contracts and cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is one of them, as you probably know. Smart contracts are reducing the human factor in transaction processing and verification. To give you an example of blockchain's application in insurance, I'll give you one now. In the 12 months to May 2015, there were 558,000 passengers who had cover for delayed or cancelled flights, and they didn't claim. In fact, it's believed that just under 40% of individuals with that type of cover who have the ability to claim do not claim. Now, in last year's September London FinTech Week, there was a team involved in that, in one of the challenges there, which built an insurance contract for those customers where the conditions were held on blockchain. The smart contract used publicly available data to trigger the claim when necessary. So a delayed flight is a matter of fact and public record. So the event occurs, the smart contract triggers, and without cost, without delay, the appropriate parties are paid for their claim. Excuse me. Now, we can imagine this transferring over into the life space. Obviously, there's perhaps some of the events of late would make us wonder whether maybe terms and conditions need to be tightened for that to happen. And the other use of blockchain is actually in prediction markets. Those who have been following the US elections will have heard of prediction markets being referenced by almost every media outlet who wants to judge how well someone's doing. Effectively, prediction markets are harnessing the wisdom of the crowd. And in fact, there's some may scoff at that and not quite believe it, but there's actually quite a good academic base for that being valuable. Hence why prediction markets have done so well and are continuing to grow. And there's implications here for actuaries. On the face of it, actuaries use deep and liquid financial information to form views about the future. Now, who knows if one day prediction markets will actually be inputting in actuarial models for other non-financial aspects. And sorry, I'll also talk about big data, despite it being a taboo subject yesterday. We are said now to be in the age of big data. Harvard Business School have said that the data scientist is the sexiest job of the 21st century, and I'm guessing that pushes actuary into second, so that's disappointing for all of us here. Big data is a very broad subject, and I'll only cover it very, very, very lightly, unfortunately, but hopefully it will give some flavour. It has a vast variety of applications across the insurance value chain. These range from marketing and distribution, personalisation of products and cross-selling, customer management insofar as we know our customers better, underwriting and risk management, developing our better risk models, claims management, so the ability to detect large losses early, or using text mining in quotation processes or claims to find indications of fraud. Now, I want to draw a separation between big data and what I would call bigger data, or large amounts of rich data. Big data is characterized by its volume, velocity, variety, and veracity. Maybe we'll come back to that later. And also, the interesting thing about big data is it has metadata as well, includes metadata, which is data about the data. So it's quite multidimensional and huge. Bigger data, on the other hand, is data that's typically collected over a long time frame. It's highly rich and contains lots of detail, and it's actually takes quite a bit of effort to collect too. An example of what I mean by bigger data could be a primary care data set where that's been accumulated centrally and can be used for medical science, and obviously that could be very valuable for actuaries too, who wish to have a deeper look underneath the surface of claims, underneath the line we draw for mortality curves and so on, understand the processes going on deeper within that, because we don't just wake up and die one day. Usually there's a process where we go through disease and then get a secondary disease, and that's what ultimately becomes our end. Some people still do wake up and die, unfortunately, too. Aggregators. It's said, actually, the best characteristic about life insurance is perhaps its abundance of choice. It's probably intimately linked with one of the worser characteristics, which is complexity and lack of comparability across products. Aggregators attempt to give comparable information on the features and to help customers make better decisions on price. So many sites are already operating in Australia in the aggregator context. And those that work best provide the best prices to this and meet the specific customer needs. In 2012 and 2015, Google entered the UK and the US with aggregator websites. That was in the general insurance space. It's since actually closed them down. However, in the interim, it did form Alphabet, and Alphabet, being its parent company, the umbrella organisation, signifies Google's interest in perhaps broadening out its activities, potentially into financial services. Now, Colin did throw cold water on that yesterday, so I won't predict any more on that, but he did leave it a little bit open. But one of the common cited drawbacks of aggregators is whether they have really the ability to do justice to the nuances of life insurance products, and also the potential for bias if they're linked too intimately to a particular company or distributor.
Oops. Sorry, no, wrong way.
And on to our last one, robo-advice. This has grown rapidly in the UK and the US in the last 3 years. In Australia, there's believed to be no fewer than 41 robo-advisors in development or in operation today. That's a statistic, well, a statistic based on just on the end of last year. ASIC themselves have said they're very supportive of the automation of provision of advice and its potential to offer convenient low-cost services. So that's a promising statement from them. Currently, robo-advice focuses heavily on the accumulation phase of savings. However, there are several planning to extend into general and life insurance. And the advantages that are experienced by those wealth managers can transfer over equally. These include lowering restrictions, so giving access to advice to beyond just customers who are the mass affluent or wealthy, and giving right round-the-clock access to advice too, and reducing the amount of time it takes for a customer to get advice, get good advice. Robo-advisors also have the ability to reduce conflicts of interest and potentially reverse growing lack of trust that's been developed perhaps since the GFC and various advice scandals along the way around the world. So what does this all mean? I've set out a simplified insurance value chain there on the top. I'd just like to give a sort of view as to where some of these technologies may fit along there. So I've placed them very roughly across that value chain where perhaps their strengths are most visible. Some of them, such as big data, has most likely more wider implications. But just to summarise quickly through these, so we've looked at aggregators, so some doubts over the suitability, but we've already seen examples emerge. Robo-advice promises to bring advice mainstream and potential to impact insurance is potentially yet to be seen. Big data has a sort of very broad range of impacts, and insurers are working on those as we speak. Telematics, there's still some challenges there, but the potential prize on the sales side potentially and cross-selling is potentially quite great. P2P, maybe in the life insurance space, perhaps the viability is yet to be fully made clear. And in blockchain, we're still very much in the early stages, but we are seeing general insurance applications growing. So on that, I'll pass back to Paul to conclude.
Thanks, Ken. I probably want to conclude by just asking a series of questions, and I'm not expecting you to answer them, of course. The life insurance industry has strong customer affinity with the life insurer. It has efficient processes, which leads to great customer experience. It's cost-effective, viewed as value for money by the customer. Life companies are nimble and they're able to adapt quickly to changing trends. And then life insurance is sold, not bought, and the customer is the advisor. I think if you think through a lot of those points, it does lead to quite clearly that we should expect disruption in the life insurance space. Potential sources of disruption are numerous, and look, we've covered a few, and I don't think it's going to be blockchain per se, but it might be blockchain combined with robo-advisor combined with big data, and how organisations then will use those combinations. There's various parts of the life insurance valued chain that are susceptible or more susceptible to disruption. And so you could see really disruption happening within components of that value chain. Look, that's not to say that the insurance and financial services industry is kind of sitting still and waiting for these disruptors to come. I think there's been a lot of investment now within the industry, and I'm going to use the industry here to mean life insurers, and they're owned by banks, they're banks, and then by if they're owned by a global company, the global company. You know, we've seen the establishment of innovation labs, particularly by a lot of the kind of regional global players, and also through the banking group, financial services organisations. We've seen groups now taking either a percentage share or taking full ownership of a lot of these innovative technologies. I mean, the banks have definitely invested directly in a lot of blockchain or organisations that are utilising blockchain technologies. And even if you then go down more to the micro level, I mean, a lot of companies are now set up they'll have a, you know, chief digital distribution person or a head of data analytics, head of customer experience, etc. And so, look, I think insurers are acknowledging the potential for disruption and are trying to manage that through various means. I mean, interestingly, with a lot of this investment, are insurers almost leading to their own disruption? I'll finish with a quote from Winston Churchill. It's not the end, it's not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Well done. Very interesting talk. It's the first time I've ever heard the term chief behavioural officer. I thought that was the head of HR, but obviously the world's changing. So there's a mic in the middle of the room, just to make you all very uncomfortable asking a question in front of everyone. Would you mind jumping to the mic and stating your name if there are any questions from the audience? In the meantime, what are you thinking? Should I give you guys one? So probably going back to your last piece, Paul. Bit of a more controversial question, I guess, and it's a bit of a cliche as well. Have life insurers really ever innovated in the last 10 to 20 years in a way that's fundamentally shifted something on product or distribution or selection? So, you know, arguably the biggest last innovation people talk about is critical illness. Is that an unfair statement? That's the first part of the question. And then the second part is what do you think is holding us back? So do we have the right structures in life insurers? Is there something that fundamentally holds the industry back from really innovating meaningfully?
Well, look, I think that's probably a slightly unfair comment. I mean, if you look back into the... I'll take liberty and take maybe 20 to 30 years ago. I mean, life insurers were the first companies to adopt large mainframe computing. In basically Australia, I know that at least. And so I do think they were at that stage very open to adopting new technology. Now you might say, well, 30 years ago is a long time ago. But if you just go back even probably 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I mean, the introduction of unit-linked business, I think, was a significant disruptor to the whole market, and it was kind of led through the life insurance industry. If you think through the master trust structures, I mean, I think it was really the life insurance companies that were at the forefront of developing those, developing that industry. Now, don't get me wrong, there was niche providers that kind of set them up, and the life companies then bought those master trust organisations, but I think they were kind of very much at the forefront of that. If you think about the evolution of the distribution network and the advisory network and the evolution moving from, you know, your tied agent through to your financial advisors. And I think a lot of that, whilst maybe some would argue life companies were dragged by the regulators, I mean, I think a lot of the life companies were actually at the forefront of moving to more of an advice-based model there rather than a kind of, lower quality sell type structure with the tight agency force. So I think there has been quite a bit of innovation that's gone through a life company. Now, if you think about a life company now, I mean, they're really kind of multiple entities. I mean, you know, they're large wealth providers, as well as being, you know, large superannuation and then, you know, large life companies as well. So, yeah, I think there has been quite a significant amount of innovation, evolution, you know, depending on the words you want to use. I mean, even to the evolution of the kind of independent IFAs, and obviously the life companies were, you know, responded by actually buying up these independent financial advisors to shore up their distribution networks. The movement into direct market, I mean, I think is in its infancies, but it's again been, I think life companies are being thinking forward about how they can potentially innovate. And I use the word innovate there rather than disrupt, because I don't know that that's per se a disruptor coming in. What do I think is now potentially a barrier for life companies for future disruptions? Look, I think it can be a couple of factors. There's no doubt that the infrastructure of life companies, a lot of legacy systems, a lot of complicated infrastructure, a lot of complicated products, and I think that does distract and slow down the potential to disrupt or react to market trends quickly. I do think that potentially there has been less focus on the end consumer as the customer as opposed to the advisor as the customer, and so I think there's been more of a disconnect from the end purchaser of the goods through to the life company. I mean, a lot of customers would probably view their advisor as their supplier as opposed to the life company. So they're now one step removed from, or more so removed from the end client. And dare I say, being part of a big bureaucratic organisation can often detract as well and make it more difficult. That's not to say that you can't be big and still have innovation.
Well, linked to that, what is best practice? What are good companies doing to encourage innovation within their companies? And you're right, innovation, disruption, probably a bit interlinked sometimes.
I'm going to keep to financial services. Look, I think what they're acknowledging that, I mean, innovation labs, for example, are kind of like acknowledging we're big, you know, we've got lots of our daily work. And so they set up these innovation labs to kind of say, we need some really smart people. And that's not to say we don't have smart people in our normal organisation. But let's take some of our smart people and let's just put them to focus on what's out there. How can we leverage that? How can we get smarter? The other thing that a lot of organisations are doing is they're looking at how do they simplify their products? How do they simplify their systems? And so how does that make them become potentially more responsive to change when it does come? And so even if you look at the big investments the banks have made in IT and infrastructure, it's been massive over the last 3 to 5 years in a position to make them a little bit more nimble, in inverted commas. And I think there's also an acknowledgement through organisations now that we need to be thinking about how do we do things differently, how do we do things smarter, and how do we make ourselves more customer-centric.
Dennis Wilkinson, and thanks for the presentation. I think it's a very interesting one, and one which we'll need to continue to monitor closely as things go through. Two comments, one about what has happened, one about what is starting to happen. Sometimes disruptors occur and we don't even see that they've actually occurred. If you think of the presentations you've just put through at the moment, you think about the Australian life insurance market, it has already been significantly disrupted. 35% to 40% of all life insurance premiums now come through superannuation funds. That insurance has not been sold. It's been provided through an automatic process, in most cases, through a default structure. That has completely and fundamentally changed the nature of the way life insurance is actually operating within the Australian market. But it's happened gradually. It's happened in a way in which we've all sort of understood it. But it has changed some of those dynamics already. It is a disruptor. It's an aggregator of its own form. It's changed quite significantly. I'd be interested in your comments as to whether you see that as being a disruptor that's already occurred. The second thing is what's happening with telematics, but more importantly, I think what's now available through genetic information. I can get a genetic test done through the state now for about $35 or so that basically tells me what my life expectation is really going to be at a personal level. And I can monitor that going forward from here. Now, the life insurance industry traditionally has not used that information unless it's provided. But there is an opportunity now to actually assess and price at an individual level, far more so than in a pooled level. But that has enormous consequences for actuaries and pricing and how that might apply not only to a contract now, but how you would reassess that as you get more information on that individual over time. I'd be interested to see how you think that might develop for the industry going forward from here.
I'll just address that last one, if that's okay. I was very interested when 23andMe came up yesterday on the slides. One of the interesting developments with 23andMe, though, is mid last year, the FDA decided that they would no longer be able to provide information on how those genes are likely to affect their disease outcome. So they've really kind of they've caught up with 23andMe and started imposing how things should be done with that product. I think that's probably an example of where regulation is probably a step behind and can sometimes come into. So actually, I understand now that 23andMe only provides ancestry information and not disease information. But there's potentially others out there that which still would do. And then your point about individualization in terms of genetics, I think in the UK we've been dealing with this for a while, and there's quite a lot of individuals who've been studying it, and myself included a while back. The UK has a moratorium now, so for some specific conditions, and they're relatively rare, one of them at least anyway, that's the only type of test which you may have to do if your insurance coverage is of a very large amount, which would be the equivalent of over $1 million coverage here. So, I think and that moratorium has been put in place to protect customers from being forced to hand over information or being asked to have tests unless in very specific circumstances where there's a risk to the industry. And that risk is adverse selection, where those individuals are selecting against the insurance company going into the policy, which I don't think is beneficial for anybody. Well, except for that one individual.
I mean, just to add that, I mean, one of my concerns is that we'll get to the state where we just know too much about people, in which case 80% of the people aren't going to get insurance and the other 20% are going to get it, but it's very cheap, but they probably don't need it to begin with in the first place. So, look, I do think there is a danger of knowing too much, and that then leads down to individual risk rating and leads to a significant imbalance within that. As far as the super fund industry goes, I agree with your comment. I think there has been a level of disruption in the way things have operated. Is it going to be further disruption in that from that area? I think the answer is yes, but I don't know that it's going to come directly from the super funds. It may well come from an organisation that partners with the super funds to provide that next leap of disruption, potentially.
Mark Muir. Continuing on from your point, what you were saying about how the consumer may know more information, anti-selection, for example, I think there needs to be a balance between information asymmetry. So in the past, it used to lie with the consumer, where they used to potentially know more about themselves than the insurer did. But now going forward with all these, you know, wearables and genetic tests and all this information, that gets passed to the insurer, where the individual may not be able to decipher what's coming out of that data. But the insurers do. Now the insurers are starting to know more about the individuals than they know about themselves, you know, and they can potentially, as you say, charge down to the individual or decline cover in certain circumstances. So I think it needs to move to a balance, the information asymmetry between the insurer and the consumer or the individual, and I think that provides a challenge in itself. So that was the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing was on blockchain technology, you were talking about how that could, potentially sort of automate claims, use public information and straight away feed through and start the claims process. And I think you mentioned a stat, I can't remember what it was, maybe 40% of claims don't actually get made. But don't you think that that's already And I think it's great for consumers if it does become more automated and less onerous for them, and claims get made that they potentially wouldn't have made themselves. But then if you look at experience analyses and pricing or whatever at the moment, it's obviously feeding through, right, in experience. Whereas if you now say, okay, add that extra 40% of claims, what impact is that going to have on pricing or affordability of insurance there if every single claim is actually processed and made?
Yeah, I'd hate to have a developed insurance product where people can claim. I understand your point on that. Look, blockchain for life insurance, it is going to rely on a lot of other pieces coming together. So, for example, if we actually do develop a centralised medical database, I mean, that could revolutionise underwriting and claims management. And if you think about critical illness, it's got to go through your medical records, hospital, measuring of heart attack, level of cancer, etc., then, yeah, blockchain will automatically register that these incidences have occurred via the access to that information and then make the payment out. But I think that's still a long way away for life insurance. I don't think blockchain per se is going to be significantly revolutionising life insurance. I think it's going to impact big-time banks and financial services, general insurance to a lesser extent, and then it might be life insurance, you know, I'll put out a number, 15 years from now. I don't think that's going to be the big change, but it's the combination of these different things.
Yeah. I think the interesting one is the mixture of blockchain and peer-to-peer, where effectively you really are eliminating a lot of intermediaries when you put those two together. And all you need is a platform to bring customers together, which obviously we know there are many out there.
We've got time for maybe a couple more questions. If there's anyone else in the audience. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Caroline Bennett. Having recently attended Singularity University, which for those who aren't familiar with it is a global organisation focused on the impact of exponential technologies, I guess they had an interesting observation that the features of incumbents that made them successful in the 20th century are almost exactly the same features that lead them to be highly challenged in the 21st. So I guess that was one piece. I guess the second is that I guess disruption in industries and to companies often manifests itself in a gradual deterioration in profitability followed by a cliff. And I guess given what we know about life insurance profitability and the incumbents, I was interested in whether you've taken the positive, which is fantastic, and rebirth, but I guess I was interested in whether you'd also contemplated the possibility of the cliff.
Well, I'm hitting 50, so I've only got 10 years to worry about. In any kind of disruption, there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. There's going to be some companies where management just sticks their head in the sand and says, I'm an ostrich and everything's going to be the way it's going to be for the next 10 years. But there'll be other companies that will be much more open and adept. So, I can't answer that question, but I think you'll find it'll change in the landscape and there'll be some winners and there'll be some losers. Are we going through some level of disruption? I think we're seeing aspects of it that leads to the different disruption. So, for example, I think we're seeing a step change in consumer behaviour. And so that step change in consumer behaviour is going to open them up to other avenues in the next stage. So I do think that's going to happen. Is the current kind of reducing returns an issue? Well, I'm not sure that that's really part of the picture. I think that's more just coming through some of the kind of cycles that we're coming through. It's going to be a very interesting issue for the banking sector in Australia, more so than the life insurance industry. But, of course, the banks own they own less now, I suppose, than they did last year. But they own a number of life companies, obviously, and that's going to flow through. So if you look at the kind of key strategies of the banks, A lot of it's been our revenue's maxed out, our profit's up the top. We're going to have to really cut costs now to kind of get the next squeeze of the lemon through growth in underlying profits. So I do think that, and the banking sector, I do think is open to some big, I mean, one of the stats that I find just frightening is the top four banks in Australia make, after tax, $1,500 for every woman, man and child in Australia. And I just think someone's got to be sitting over the seas going, that's a market I want to get into.
I think the second bell's gone, so apologies, guys. There are a few more questions there. Probably a great way to finish off. So can you please join me in wishing these guys congratulations?